Hey everyone, it's the Kung Fu Genius, aka Alex Richter. And if you're listening to us on audio only, I'd appreciate you rating and reviewing the podcast wherever you listen to it. And of course, if you like what I do here, don't forget to subscribe to the Kung Fu Genius on YouTube and hit that bell for notifications. Are you a fan of Wing Chun Kung Fu? Well, if you listen to me, I assume you are. I got great news for Kung Fu Genius fans. Right now, you can get an all-access one-month free trial subscription to Wing Chun Illustrated Magazine. Yes, I said free. Go to wcinewsstand.com and register in the upper right-hand corner, fill in your email and password, and use the code KFGTRIAL to get your free trial to the issues from 2011 to the current issue. That's right, all the issues, even the one with this guy on the cover. My Kung Fu Genius column is in all the new issues, as if you need another reason to get this awesome magazine. Go get your free trial subscription today. For all that information, check out the description below. And with that, let's get started.
All right, peeps. On today's episode of The Kung Fu Genius, The Genius will be breaking down the Bruce Lee Ted Thomas interview. Lots of gems, lots of violent anger, and lots of I am definitely no saint. Let's get to it.
He is unstoppable, unbeatable, unbelievable. He's Alex Richter, the Kung Fu Genius.
And every day, I practice martial arts. What's up?
Word is, I'm a Kung Fu Genius. Practice all day like a genius.
Yo, Dre, how you doing, man?
Oh, I'm doing good, Sifu.
You still got that post-vacation glow going on.
I am trying to hold on to this glow.
Yeah. When you got that glow...
As long as I can.
You feel as one. When you got the glow, your mind, body, and soul... I can't sing that song, but you know what I'm talking about, right?
You got the glow.
When you got the glow, right?
You feel as one.
Do you think Timok still has the glow?
I think he might be trying to hold on to the glow like I am.
Yeah, maybe a little bit too long.
A little too long. He's bringing it out.
So here we are. We're going to do another Bruce Lee conversation because way back in the infancy of the Kung Fu Genius podcast, we did the Dan Lee phone conversation, the one that was secretly recorded, meaning that
that's
Bruce Lee
unveiled.
That's right. Yeah. Bruce Lee did not know he was being recorded. And in my opinion, that's one of the best conversations because you don't have Bruce Lee kind of filtering himself for the media. You have him having a pretty unfiltered conversation
talking
with one of his
students.
Talking shit.
Grade A.
That's right. Using some profanity, which we are all for at the Kung Fu Genius podcast. and there were a lot of gems in there. And that, I think, was a 22-minute phone conversation. And we broke that down into four parts.
Mm-hmm.
So we're able to talk for over 4 hours. About a 22-minute phone conversation, all right? This is called stretching it for more and more content.
Sir.
This conversation that we're going to do today is an interview that Bruce Lee had on the radio, on RHK, Radio Hong Kong, with a reporter named Ted Thomas. Now, originally, I think in a last podcast or in a couple other ones, I may have made a mistake. I think I said that the Ted Thomas interview was over the phone while Bruce was on the set of Enter the Dragon. Apparently, that's not the case. I looked at it. This was actually an RHK radio interview, at least as far as I understood.
It should be nice and clear.
It should be, except it's like a 49-year-old radio conversation that probably the version that we got off of YouTube is like a recording of a recording, you know,
itchy and scratchy show
while someone's eating Cheetos in the background recording it, right? So that's the problem, is that you don't always have super clean audio on these things. By the way, some people said about the Dan Lee conversation, they were kind of calling me out because I didn't do the whole thing, because they were like, there's like an extra few minutes at the end. But I intentionally didn't do that part there because
I think I know why.
The last few minutes, it gets a little bit into JKD politics, and I don't want to get involved in that. I barely can stand Wing Chun politics. So the last thing I want to do is, you know, step into some other room of politics.
Trying to pull you into
they're like, yo, man, you didn't do the full thing. Let me send you the unedited version. Like, I know.
Ooh.
All right. But the last part involves one of Bruce Lee's students and what he's teaching or not teaching. And I don't want to speculate on that stuff. So that's the reason. So for those of you out there who are like, oh, you didn't do the whole Dan Lee thing. Yeah. All right. These are intentional edits. Okay.
Yes.
So anyway, the Ted Thomas interview, on RHK. I believe it's in 1972. So it's definitely after Big Boss. I don't know if Fist of Fury had come out yet. It's not clear. This interview is definitely much different from the Dan Lee phone conversation because obviously it's not a phone call with one of his students that he knows personally. Yeah, it's
more polished.
It's a more formal interview. So you have Bruce Lee, you know, talking in his more kind of public persona kind of way. But there's some interesting things in terms of like the Lao Dai Jun implications of that challenge fight. And also given the Bob Baker letters towards the end of the conversation, I think you're going to, it's interesting since those Bob Baker letters came out, you can go back and listen to the very limited Bruce Lee media that there is, you know, the stuff that he did outside of his movies. And you kind of see he was almost mentioning it. So, Yeah, so we'll get to that hopefully. So first of all, it's a 14-minute conversation. I don't know how far we're going to get into it because once we get going, you know, we might get through 2 minutes of it and we're going to have to do eight parts on this thing. So let's see. So why don't we go ahead and play the very first part?
Let's do it.
Bruce, as a screen tough guy, you're going to have to suffer what all movie heroes suffered. Challenges from exhibitionists and nuts asking you to fight, challenging you to fight. It's already begun to happen, hasn't it?
Yes, it has.
How do you deal with it?
When I first learned martial arts, I too have challenged many established instructors. And of course, some other challenging me also. But what I have learned is that challenging means one thing, is that what is your reaction to it? How does it get you?
Yeah, so interesting there. He already, you know, Ted Thomas kind of comes out of the gates talking about the challenge fights, right? Because obviously, and also we have to think about it. I think it's sometimes hard, even for us. I mean, we're old as dirt. We were around before the internet. We were around when there was just TV and radio. So we remember what it was like. But you think this is a little bit before our time. So really the only way that this information gets out there is through things like the radio or whatever TV interviews that he had. It wasn't like now where things happen and the stuff is on the internet and people can talk about it and comment about it. So now, of course, you know, we have this like immediate gratification in terms of getting information, right? But back then, an interview like this, this was a really big deal. Now think about it, this interview was in Hong Kong, so the American audience has never heard this interview and it's in English. I mean, at that time, obviously, nowadays it's on the internet, but at that time, right? So the big thing that everyone wants to know is, you know, especially, you know, Asia at that time, Hong Kong, Japan, everything was so mystified. You're over there and people didn't understand the culture and they just had these little tidbits from movies that made them think they understood the culture and they thought that, you know, everyone there is kung fu fighting. I'll always remember the first time I went to Hong Kong in 1996. Even though I was 18, in my, you know, so I'm not like a young child, but I'm technically an adult, but not really. I still had this idea that I was going to go to Hong Kong and like everyone there was going to be kung fu fighting. Like I had this idea, like you would see kung fu masters everywhere you went.
Oh, right.
And, you know, like that kung fu culture would be very like present in and your in face, your face, right? And that was not at all the case. I mean, you've come to Hong Kong with me and you know that nowadays, if you want to find Kung Fu in Hong Kong, you got to know where it is and you got to go there and you have to know people. You don't just really stumble into it unless obviously you go to a park in the morning and you see someone practicing some martial arts there, whatever. It's not kind of as in your face as one would think. Well, even in 96, it was still not that different from how it is now in terms of like you had to go and find it. And I remember, you know, walking around and seeing everybody, you know, dressed ultra modern and everyone like, you know, being just into lots of Western things and like just going like, yo, where are all the kung fu peeps, right? And you know how I found, because obviously in 96, this is really before the internet, before smartphones and stuff. So I go to Hong Kong, is, you know, this is like the first time I go there. I went there with two books. I had John Little's. He had one book about the philosophy of Bruce Lee. I think it had Warrior in the title, but I don't remember the exact title right now. But I brought that book. So oddly enough, John Little, who we've had on this podcast, I had one of his books. And the other one was Bay Logan's Action Cinema. And so those are like the two books I brought, right? But I go to Hong Kong, I'm like, where is the Kung Fu stuff? So you know how I actually found some Kung Fu stuff in Hong Kong? The hotel had a Yellow Pages. And I just opened the Hong Kong Yellow Pages.
I don't know if our audience...
And yeah, the phone book, right? And I just look at the Kung Fu section. If they had a couple Kung Fu shops, and I literally went there and bought some stuff and then asked those people, like, where are these schools? And that's actually how I found stuff the first time I went to Hong Kong. Like, I just, like, so, straight out of the phone book, right? So, but anyway, people wanted to know, like, well, if you're over there, if you do martial arts, the assumption is everyone is kung fu fighting, because that's what you see in the movies. Every, you turn the corner, there's a bunch of kung fu thugs that want to fight you, and you're always fighting, right? So, obviously, he asked him about the challenge fights. Now, at this time, I believe this is 72, I think, this recording. So, I know that Big Boss was definitely out, because they mention it. I don't know about if Fist of Fury was out yet. They don't make mention of it, but I don't know if that's just... circumstance or the movie had not come out yet. And so at this point, he already had the famous challenge by Lao Tai Chun, whom I've talked about before.
Yes.
And this has been a big enigma in the Bruce Lee, you know, lexicon of his fights. Like, did it happen? Did it not happen? I have discussed it before on other episodes, and I'm not 100% sure. I have met people who told me that they were there at the fight.
Yeah.
And I have met other people who have told me it didn't happen.
Yeah.
And I have met people who weren't there, but were told, you know, what had happened. And I heard a recording, and I cannot say where I got it, of someone who was very close to Bruce Lee. It's in Cantonese, who claims he witnessed it and described the fight itself. So the problem is, it's still very inconclusive. All right. So, like, did it happen? Did it not happen? But what's interesting is recently, partially in preparation for doing this episode, I was looking at the books of Steve Kerridge. Now, if for our fans out there who are hardcore Bruce Lee fans, you know who Steve Kerridge is. He's written a couple really fantastic books about Bruce Lee. I think one is called Way of the Intercepting Fist. The other one is The Mandarin Superstar. And beautiful books with, you know, amazing photos, really high quality photos. And they're kind of done almost like in picture story format. But he's really done his research. When you look at his books, he really like went in and got stories from people who were in the cast and background and everything like that. And what was very amazing cool. is, you know, I've been looking up, I've been trying to find out about this Lao Tai Chun thing for so long, right? And I'm looking in, you know, the Chinese internet and looking in Chinese Google and looking at Chinese YouTube, right? Because for martial art fans out there...
That's how you find the gems.
Well, one thing you can do, if you want to see stuff that doesn't normally come up on your YouTube, you know, put in the three characters for Bruce Lee's name in Chinese, Lei Xiulong. Put those characters in, search that. And you're going to get Chinese YouTube, and you're going to get Chinese Google. And that brings you down a whole other rabbit hole of stuff that you normally don't see in English, right? So I've gone down the Lao Tai Chun Chinese rabbit hole, and there's really not a whole lot. And I've gone down the English rabbit hole, also not a whole lot. But oddly enough, Steve Kerridge actually had a few things in his book that kind of talked about this, which gives a little bit of context to what Bruce is about to say here. And Lao Tai Chun is basically what the Cantonese call a kelefe. Kelefe is an extra, a movie extra. Yeah. Literally a Mr. Nobody, right? Like if you're like a dude who, you're just like some crappy TVB actor or something like that, and you're Mr. Nobody, right? You call them a kelefe. And so Lao Tai Chun was a kelefe. If you go to the Hong Kong movie database, not IMDb, like there's one called hkmdb.com. And they're like the IMDb, but for Hong Kong films. You put in, and they're very, very complete.
He doesn't have a photo.
No, he does. But the thing is, he made like four movies.
Okay.
And only one movie did he have a character that had a name. All of the other movies was like,
was like
brothel boss or like waiter or like, you know, the son
janitor.
Of the whatever. Yeah, he only had one movie where he actually had a character that had a name in the movie. So he was really... like a nobody. And so it's very clear because I heard his name and I was like, well, I never heard of Lao Tai Chun. Well, it turns out he was really like a C or D list actor. Now, but he did apparently have a legit martial arts pedigree. He was supposedly a bantamweight boxing champion. Now, they say boxing champion. All right. Now, was he really a champion, or was he a bantamweight boxer who had some fights? And if he was a champion, like, at what level? You know what I mean? Like, it's very vague, right? And so, like, I don't know how legit of a champion. He might have been a real legit champion. He might have been, well, whatever. He said his father was some kind of wrestling champion as well.
Okay.
So he came apparently from a family of martial artists. And in addition to boxing, he did, I believe, a style called Takun, which I don't really know what that is. I just read it. And so anyway, he did apparently have some martial arts pedigree. But when you look at him, he's kind of just a doughy looking dude. Like, he's not like, he doesn't look like the Chinese version of Ivan Drago. All right.
Okay.
You know, he looks more like, yeah, he's just a doughy dude.
Fluffy.
Yeah, he's a little bit on the fluff. Yeah. So you go like, okay. Well, it's clear why he didn't really become a big movie star, right? So anyway, I was reading in Steve Kerridge's book, The Way the Intercepting Fist. And he had an interview with a someone who was a makeup artist on Fist of Fury. And I believe his name was Chan Gok Hong. Now, I don't know exactly how to pronounce that because it's only written there. I don't know the Chinese character, so I don't know which Gok and which Hong it is, right? So I can't guess the exact pronunciation. But anyway, he was the makeup artist, and he said one day, like, Bruce was kind of... He was seemingly irritated at Golden Harvest Studios and in Studio C, apparently. All right. Mm. And he was there with some other martial artists and he was kind of going off a little bit. And it apparently had to do with the Lao Tai Chun challenge, because Lao Tai Chun had challenged Bruce kind of in the back doorway. He wrote a letter. And then I think he sent that letter to the newspapers. And I don't know if the newspapers picked it up or not. And then New Martial Hero, which is a very famous, they're kind of like the Black Belt magazine of Hong Kong at that time. They, I think, printed the letter or at least made an article about the letter. And then suddenly it came out there. And the idea was that he was formally challenging Bruce Lee. So this makeup artist said that Bruce was irritated. He was saying, like, look, I'm not going to have a formal open challenge fight with this guy because he's basically a kelefe. He's a nobody. And he's obviously just doing this to make a name for himself. And some people might see that as a cop out, but it's totally true. I mean, look, if you're the champion, mm-hmm. if you're the big star, you don't have to fight any idiot who comes along your way.
It's
you know,
not
what
like
I mean?
An Apollo Creed where he's searching yeah. for KLFA.
Well, not really. I mean, well, if you go back to Rocky, why did Apollo have to get some? Why did he have to fight someone else? Because the guy he was gonna fight got injured.
Right.
And he didn't want to pull out of the fight. And that was the idea about yeah. giving the local guy yeah. thing. Right? So he wasn't initially looking for it. So go easy on Apollo. OK, he wasn't looking for a Mr. Nobody to fight. All right. So anyway, you know, Bruce, I mean, look, if you're the champion, if you're John Jones, you're anyone at the top of the food chain, you're just because somebody calls you out. You go, oh, I have to fight him because he called me out. No, absolutely not. And it's very clear that Lao Tai Chun is really a Mr. Nobody who's trying to call out Bruce Lee. And Bruce sees right through this ruse,
but
right?
But he went through the papers.
Yeah. And Bruce basically, you know, said there, he said, I'm not going to fight this guy openly because this is giving the guy the publicity he wants. But he said that he would fight him privately. And according to this makeup artist, Bruce said he would fight him there at Golden Harvest Studios or whatever, right? And so it seems that there was a lot of back and forth going on between the two, right? Lao Tai Chun wrote in the letter that he wrote, which Steve Kerridge has the original, like a photo of the original letter in his book, which is why I'm like, I've been going down this Lao Tai Chun rabbit hole forever and wanted to know more. And literally it's in Steve Kerridge's book, right? And I was messaging with him a few weeks ago. I would like to have him on the podcast.
Oh, that would be
lit. For our Kung Fu Genius listeners, let me know in the comments below if you want me to have Steve Kerridge on this podcast. And if you don't, I'll probably have him on anyway.
Yeah.
So anyway, because I want to have that conversation, right? So anyway, he has a copy of the letter in there in Chinese and then like a translation of it, right? And it's interesting because the reason why Lao Tai Chun was his jump off point to get this publicity was that Bruce had done an interview on Hong Kong TV. I believe it was one of the first interviews, if not the first. Mm. And Bruce was critical of the Hong Kong Chinese martial arts scene. And he said that those guys were full of gong xiao, which is like a
gong sao.
Talking hands. But he doesn't mean it in a, like in the traditional Wong Sun Leung way, which is to talk with the hands. He means like talk about the hands, right?
Okay.
And not enough like actually sparring or whatever, right? Which, by the way, is true. Okay, I mean, we now know it took the Chinese Kung Fu world a little bit of time to realize, like, yeah, for many years, I think the reason why Chinese Kung Fu suffered is because you just had many Chinese Sifu talking. And meanwhile, the rest of the martial arts world, whether it was karate or jujitsu or whatever, they're going out and they're fighting and they're competing and they're doing different things and their martial arts are developing. And the Chinese martial arts are staying more and more hidden, more and more reclusive. And things do not develop in isolation. They rot. And so you have a rich Chinese martial arts history and culture and lots of really great techniques that are not being polished through they're not being forged through sparring and fighting and openness. They're being kind of held in secret and Chinese martial arts becomes extremely tribal until the point where it's like, what are you guys even arguing about, right? And so Lao Taijun pretends that he was somewhat offended by this, right? And in the letter, he's very polite, like, oh, maybe it's a misunderstanding and people told me that you're very skilled and maybe we would have a chance to discuss martial arts for techniques for film. And it's so funny when you go back and see his Hong Kong movie database and you're like, oh, Bruce is literally the top of the food chain. This is a guy who's playing brothel boss number six in some movie no one's ever heard of. And he's like, yeah, maybe we can have an exchange.
There's six bosses.
Yeah, there's six bosses.
Yeah.
I want to be in that movie.
That's right. But maybe maybe we can have an exchange about martial arts on film. And it's like, dude, get in line. You're a nobody. You're literally a nobody, bro. Right? And also, the thing is, he had Lao Taijun had about 4 credits on a Hong Kong movie database. And his last movie was 74, which was a year after Bruce Lee died. And then nothing again. Then literally nothing. It's like he disappeared into the ether.
Still around?
I have no idea. He's like a ghost. Shit. All right? He's either not around or he's, selling widgets in Thailand or something like that. I have no idea. If he held a gun to my head, I don't even think I could find... there's a way to even research whether he's still alive or not.
Wow.
Yeah. So anyway, that's how Lao Taijun did it. He did it with this letter and then saying we can have a sparring and I'm going to show you it's not just about, talking hands and blah, blah, blah. And he did this, but literally he's Mr. Nobody. Now, the funny thing is, Lao Taijun has this open challenge to Bruce, which is through letters and media and all these sideways kind of things, right? And again, it's not like the internet. Like, if some nobody challenges someone now, that's like a story on Bloody Elbow tomorrow, right? But in these days, there was a cavernous gap between the normal person and media and your access to media. I mean, in terms of like being in the media. Mm-hmm. Now it's like one-to-one, right? So there's that issue. Another Chinese Sifu also challenged Bruce Lee. And so apparently this seemed to become a trend because Bruce is the young guy. He's the upstart. He's being critical of the Chinese martial arts scene, and the Chinese martial arts scene in Hong Kong, even to this day, is still a bit tribal and I have lots of great friends in the Chinese martial arts field in Hong Kong, people that I respect quite a bit. But I've never been in a circle of martial artists in Hong Kong, whether it was Hong Kun, Wing Chun, Choy Le Fat, whatever, where there wasn't a degree of them talking shit about the other people in their style. Either they're talking shit about the other styles, they're talking shit about the instructor from another style. That guy's not doing it right this year. That guy stole that guy's... It's mostly gossip over yum cha. And then the practice is like kind of a secondary thing. And, I never once walked into the Wing Chun Athletic Association where there weren't just people sitting there talking and chatting and practicing in the most casual of ways. Where you walk into a Thai boxing gym in Hong Kong and you see people training. And you walk into a Wing Chun school in Hong Kong and it's mostly just people talking, right? Ooh. Including people from my own lineage. This is not an outward criticism. This is a general criticism, right? And so if people walk into my school while classes are going on, more likely than not, unless the instructor is explaining something, you're going to see people training and doing stuff, right? It's not always the case in Hong Kong. So anyway, a Choy Le Fat master named, I think it was Chan Seng Biu, 50 years old, pretty stout guy, looks like, kind of very archetypical Chinese Kung Fu guy. Yeah. And I tried to Google him, but actually didn't find a whole lot on him. But kind of like a stout dude, the wristbands and everything, kind of typical, almost Chu Chi Ling looking dude, right? And he challenged Bruce Lee to a fight as well. But of course, dude's in his 50s, right? And we're talking like peak Bruce. It's like, calm down, buddy. And but again, like, you know, there's like, there's, it's like now a thing, right? Lao Tai Jun challenges Bruce in the media, and then this Charlie Futt guy kind of goes on there, right? And like, you know, and then it becomes this like back and forth kind of thing, right? And so I have a feeling those are the ones that you can read about now. Like, Steve, you know, most of this information I got out of Steve Kerridge's book, and that's the stuff that he was able to put in there. I'm sure if you took a little bit of time to go through maybe some of the old newspapers, mm-hmm. I'm sure that every chucklehead and their cousin after Lao Tai Chun did this thing was trying to like jump in on that bandwagon, like call Bruce Lee out for the defense of the yeah. honor of Chinese martial arts.
Yeah, like that's
and, work, right? You know, and you know, challenge him, right? Now, funny thing, so the Chan Sing Biu guy challenges Bruce, and then another guy's surname, Choi, I think Choi Soi, what is his name? I have his notes. Oh, Choi Soi Cheng. All right. Again, mm-hmm. I don't know the exact character, so I don't know if it's Choi or Choi. Like, I don't know what exactly, because I'm just writing how his name is transcribed. I didn't see the Chinese characters. So he was a huge, I guess he was apparently a martial artist, this Choi guy, and he loved Bruce Lee. And he was like, screw you, Lao Tai Chun and Chan Sing Biu. Like,
oh, yeah.
I'll defend Bruce Lee's honor defense. And fight all you, right? So then this guy jumps in on it, right?
Oh, okay.
And he's like, you know, you have offended Bruce Lee, so you have to fight me, right? Yeah, I don't know what that guy's background was, but clearly he was some kind of martial arts guy, and he was very partial to Bruce, and he gets in there, right? Then Chan, the 50-year-old Choi Lei Fut guy, you know, he has a student named Wong who he jumps in. He's like, no, I'll fight that guy over there. And yeah. then this like ridiculous drama unfolds where like all the challengers now have these sub challengers now eating away yes. at each other. And then Bruce basically at some point, he's not even paying attention because it's just turning into some reality show nonsense. Right. The student of the Sivu who challenged him is now wants to fight the other guy who wants to fight the guys who are challenging Bruce Lee. And that
Lee know this guy defending him.
No, it doesn't say. It yeah. doesn't say. I don't okay. know. And I tried to Google the guy. I would like to get the actual Chinese character of his name because then it would be easier because
Choi.
Because it's difficult. Because also, like, you don't know if it's Choi or Choi. You don't know because there's a couple different surnames that are often transcribed the same way. So that's why I look at it. I can only guess, but it's not standard. But you can imagine that Bruce is seeing this stuff going down in the media, and then at some point he just loses interest because this is just becoming like a shit show of this guy challenging this guy challenging this guy, and that's literally great. It's all just for the publicity. And at some point he just realizes even this guy who wants to fight for Bruce Lee's honor to a certain degree is also clout chasing to use a 2021 term, yeah, like clout chasing, yeah, like right. to jump on in on that or whatever, right? So anyway, okay. let's go ahead and listen to the next yes. part.
What I've learned is that challenging means one thing, is that what is your reaction to it? How does it get you? Now, if you are secure within yourself, you treat it very, very, very lightly, because you ask yourself, am I really afraid of that man?
So what's interesting there is he yeah. basically says the same thing to Dan Lee.
Right.
So what I like about it is, you know, and of course people can choose not to believe it or not, but there's an internal consistency with how Bruce Lee kind of handles this, yeah. right? Because here he is saying openly, it's like, hey, look, when it comes to challenges, it's about how do you react to it, right? Do you, you know, do you feel personally threatened? Like, is this something that you want to take seriously or not? And do you have any fear of this person? And that's essentially echoing what he mm-hmm. would say that's to his... Dan Lee. And I believe this is might be around the time of the Dan Lee conversation, because again, we're talking about 72. From my conversations with John Little, the Dan Lee, Bruce Lee secretly recorded conversation that we did before was probably done in January of 1972, because Bruce was in the States. That phone conversation wasn't between Hong Kong and LA. It was from LA to LA. He was in LA.
Yeah.
And Bruce was selling his home in Bel Air. He was tying up some loose ends. And that is also consequently when he paid $60 on that credit card to buy those 8 pairs of pants from the Charles Damiano episode, where he had that credit card slip where Bruce yes. bought 8 pairs of pants at Fred Siegel's in LA or whatever. Yeah. And that was in January of 72. So Just given like his vibe and the things he's saying, they say the Ted Thomas interview's in 72, but I think it's also maybe before Fist of Fury comes out or around that time, which would put it around the same time as the Dan Lee conversation. So maybe we're talking the same month or within a few months or 3 months or something like that, in my estimation. Of course, I could be wrong with that. This is just me kind of spitballing it off the top of my head. If there's more information, I can, of course, amend that later. But I think it's around the time. And you hear that what he tells Ted Thomas
pretty consistent.
Is pretty consistent to what he says to his student in a private phone conversation, yeah, where he's not trying to be polished for the audience. He's just kind of shooting the shit, quite frankly, with one of his students. And he basically says, like, do I have any fear of this guy? No, I don't, right? And so it's the same thing. All right, so let's go ahead and continue.
He's going to get me. But if I do not have such doubt, and if I do not have such fear, I would certainly treat it very lightly, just as today the rain is going on strong, but tomorrow, maybe the sun is going to come out again. I mean, it's like that type of a thing.
Of course, they can't lose by challenging you. Even if they lose, they get the publicity of being a guy who actually fought.
Well, let's face it. I mean, in Hong Kong, can you have a fight? I mean, a no-hold-bar fight. Is it a legal thing? It is and isn't. And to me, you see, a lot of things, I mean, you know, like challenging and all that. I am the last to know. I am always the last to know, man. I mean, I always find out from newspapers, from reporters.
So just like what we were talking about, it's like you hear his frustrations. He's like, first of all, can you really have a fight? You know what I mean? Talking about a no holds barred fight, you know? And the other thing, too, is that his frustration about kind of being the last one to know.
Yeah, no one comes to his face and say, yo.
Yeah, I mean, partially they might not have access to him, but Hong Kong's a small place. And it at that time, I don't think it would have been super difficult to find him. And also, he used to jog on the street regularly. I mean, I think he was relatively accessible, right? But then again, you start to get the impression that Lau Tai Chun and Chan Sing Piu and all these guys, they're just putting their name out there for their own publicity and to a certain degree to posture. Like, oh, Bruce Lee's like this, you know, this great martial artist, whatever I challenged him, right? Because like for many people, like the fact that you challenge someone who's established or high level, sometimes that's enough for them to make it feel like, oh, now I'm in the same conversation as this guy. Solely because you started shit online or whatever. And to a certain degree, it's the same psychopathy that happens in YouTube comments. Okay. You know, you read YouTube comments with people and like they think that just by commenting on there that they're automatically at the same level of the guy who's in the video, right? And so it's kind of like they are inviting themselves to the table.
So if I like challenge Michael Jai White,
yes,
I'll get that clout.
You'll get that clout.
Get that clout.
Yes, exactly, right?
That Jai White clout.
Exactly. But 50 years from now, people will be watching this and they'll be all interested in the stuff we're talking about Bruce Lee and they'll be like, but who's Michael Jai White, right?
How dare you?
Anyway, so that's right. A little bit of snark there, right? Yeah, so kind of interesting, like he's that way. Now, of course, you can hear that Bruce Lee, at least outwardly, is very confident. Now, there are a lot of people, the martial arts are always so full of kind of this BS faux philosophical stuff, you know, like people are always like, well, you know, the real warrior who is confident, you know, doesn't speak and doesn't say anything or whatever. And, you know, someone who is boastful or loud is probably not really confident because they're like outwardly trying to, you know, almost prove it to themselves or whatever. And one thing I've learned being in martial arts for as long as I have been is that's bullshit. Okay. If you go into a room where people are training, let's say in an MMA gym or Brazilian jiu-jitsu gym or Thai boxing gym, and there's someone who walks in there and he looks really comfortable and he doesn't really talk and he goes in there and puts in the work and doesn't say anything, you go, that guy's probably a badass, right? Because he comes into this room full of sharks.
Comes to work.
Doesn't feel intimidated and doesn't feel like he needs to prove himself. He just comes in and does work, right? But I'll tell you, Dre, there's a guy who walks into that room of sharks and makes it all about him and starts talking all sorts of trash or whatever, and he's effing good, and he can bring it. You see what I mean? So he's, like, big and boastful, or she's, like, full of clout, like, full of, you know, talking themselves up. But then they go on the mats, and they can back it up. So this whole thing that, you know, we always have these false dichotomies. Either you are, like, you are confident, true martial artist who is quiet and humble, or you're a loudmouth braggart who's insecure.
Mm.
Okay? Now, obviously, if we look at things in their totality, probably better to be on the side of being humble and quiet and simple in that kind of way. But the problem is that it's no guarantee that if someone is quiet and acts humble,
that they're
a high-level warrior.
Okay.
They might be that way because it's a defense mechanism, or that might be the way they show their insecurity, by acting that way.
Mm.
The other person comes in, is super loud and boastful, but they can back it up, or they're loud and boastful, and they're full of shit. So the problem is that people always, they want to say this using these very black and white tropes, and go, well, Bruce is a total badass. Listen to the way he's talking about. Or the people who don't like Bruce Lee go, nah, anyone who would talk that way about themselves is clearly, you know, hiding their insecurity or whatever. And the truth is, it's like, no. All right. And obvious examples of that is you see people who are very quiet and humble and are great fighters. Anderson Silva. Okay.
Okay.
And look at someone who's the exact opposite of that. Let's say even in the jiu-jitsu world, someone like Gordon Ryan, who's like, he talks shit about everyone, but he's the best in Brazilian jiu-jitsu, and he's young, and a lot of his boastfulness and talking shit
is
also part of his age too. Like, he's a younger dude,
mm-hmm.
but he's better than all of them.
Mm.
So is his boastfulness him hiding his insecurity? I don't think so. I think he really knows that he can back it up. So the problem is, like, people need to stop viewing it through this Miyamoto Musashi lens of there's only one way to be a warrior, and there's only one way of expressing martial arts philosophy. You can say that you prefer the humble, quiet warrior, you know, it's better to be a warrior in the garden than a gardener in a war. Like, okay, like all these cool sounding, like, I get all of that stuff, okay? All right? But someone saying that they feel confident, or that, you know, they don't necessarily fear someone, could be delusional, could be a lack of experience, could be the Dunning-Kruger effect. But it could also be someone who, and that doesn't mean that he felt that he could beat everyone. He just goes, I mean, hey, I have my tools and I can do what I can do. Do I need to have fear of someone? No. Is he saying he could beat everyone? He's also not saying that, all right?
Okay.
But I think what people conflate these things, because either they will listen to the same thing and use it to say, like, well, listen to what a badass Bruce Lee is. And other people go, who real fighter talks like that? Conor McGregor?
Mike Tyson talks about feeling like the fear all the time he went into.
Absolutely, absolutely. But different people manifest it in different ways. Do you think Muhammad Ali wasn't afraid when he was going in there with Sonny Liston? No, but look at the way that he was, right?
Mm.
So there could be some insecurity there, but there also had to be, to a certain degree, a belief in his skills. And maybe that was a mechanism by which he exuded confidence, right? But the problem is to say, like, anyone who's boastful is insecure and can't really do it is bullshit, okay? This is, there are different ways of expressing that, right? Okay, let's continue.
Yeah.
Realize what the hell is happening.
Bruce, you were teaching martial arts in the States, and two of your students were Steve McQueen and James Coburn. Did you find them tough people, the way they're portrayed on the screen?
Well, first of all, James Coburn, definitely, is not a fighter. Lover, yes. I mean, he's really a super nice guy. I mean, not only that, he's a very peaceful man. He learned martial art because he finds that it is a very, very, it is like a mirror to reflect himself. You know what I mean? I mean, like, I personally believe that all type of knowledge, I don't care what it is, ultimately means self-knowledge. And that's what he is after. Now, Steve is very uptight. Steve is very high-strung, you know? Now, Steve, he can be a very good martial artist, but I hope that martial art would cool him down a little bit, maybe make him a little bit more mellower and be more peaceful.
Reminds me of one of my sea hangs. You nickname him Sparky.
Yes, exactly, right? So what's interesting here is this is very similar to what he said in the Lost interview with Pierre Burton. Because, again, what was the big talking point for a lot of English-speaking interviewers at that time, what Bruce Lee had trained James Coburn and Steve McQueen, who are two huge stars at the time, right? So that was, even though Bruce's star was like on its rise, he had this clout from his time in LA because he knew these two huge stars and was very close to them, right? So, and he basically said the same thing in the Pierre Burton interview, you know, that James Coburn's basically a peace-loving guy. And, you know, he's doing it for, he says self-knowledge, I believe it means something like self-actualization, like self-realization, right? That by using martial arts as a vehicle, mm-hmm. you can improve certain aspects of your character that is, or your being, I should say, that you can put that into all different aspects of your life, not just the fighting part. Because, I mean, honestly, what are we learning in martial arts? We're learning tools for interaction. Now, the interaction in martial arts is normally within a violent situation, but the tools of interaction are there nonetheless. You can apply these tools outside of the realm of fighting to your business relationships, to your personal relationships, right? And that doesn't mean you flick a jab at your boss. I mean, it means the strategies and the concepts and the perseverance and the need for constant adjustment and reflection that martial arts gives you. If you apply those aspects to your daily life, you can use this to improve anything, right? And so he sees, I think James is the kind of the more philosophical of the two. And I believe he also said, like, you know, because James is a peace-loving guy, and he doesn't say it here, but I believe he might have said in the Pierre Burton interview, or I may have read it, he hopes that martial arts maybe makes him a little bit more extroverted or a little bit more aggressive because he's maybe a little bit too mellow. And then in this very kind of yin-yang kind of way, Steve McQueen being very extroverted, very outward and very aggressive, he hopes that it kind of calms him down a little bit, right? And I think that that's a very beautiful sentiment for a martial arts instructor to look. I don't think Bruce Lee was a super good martial arts instructor in terms of like the day in and day out teachings. I've talked to a number of his students and people who learned from him in the regular classes and privately. And they told me that, I mean, basically Bruce was constantly, especially in the LA time, he's constantly experimenting. So you're there and he's like in this like process of trying different things out. And that's not really how you teach someone step by step. It's more just like, hey, I want to experiment with this shit. Put this helmet on and like we're going to go at it, right? And so in terms of teaching, it's maybe not the best way, but he definitely was in like this constant process. But I think that maybe what Bruce lacked in kind of a structure in terms of like, you know, in pedagogy, in terms of like how you teach, the science of teaching, he definitely seemed to look at the individual to a certain degree and try to enhance what that person probably needed mm-hmm. by using martial arts as like a way to either chill someone out or to bring someone's, you know, eye of the tiger out, depending mm-hmm. on which one they had too much of, which to a certain degree, I think that's a very beautiful philosophy for any martial arts instructors who teach any kind of martial arts, doesn't matter modern or traditional or whatever, to find what that student probably needs from the martial art. You know what I mean? Someone who's more aggressive, that martial art should be a little bit more pacifying, get them to calm down because they build their confidence. They realize they don't need to be aggressive towards others because they have physical tools. They're able to physically defend themselves. Whereas the person who's kind of afraid of their shadow probably needs to be built up a little bit, right? Interesting is that Bruce himself didn't really seem to follow that advice. Right? Because Bruce, you know, wrote all sorts of beautiful philosophy. He was so great at talking the talk in these interviews, and he was great about writing about it. But, you know, later, I think even in this interview, admits having a violent temper. You know, and we know from especially what was going on in the last months of his life, you know, pulling out a knife on Lo Wei, from, you know, his little blade belt buckle and stuff like that, and having like weird blow ups with the press, that martial arts definitely wasn't necessarily calming Bruce down. Now, of course, now with the Bob Baker letters, and we know that he had a pretty regular cocaine habit at this time, and was also taking psychedelics, which in my opinion, he probably should have been taking more of those and less cocaine. If you want to chill, Bruce, and you want to like become one, maybe take more of those mushrooms and less of that cocaine stuff,
it
man.
It was
right?
crazy. I had a mushroom growing in the lawn and she was not getting nice full cap. And I'm like, is this like psychedelic? And I walked the dog.
earlier.
I would not take that chance.
Uh-huh. No, but I walked the dog earlier and the shit is gone.
Uh-huh. The dog ate it?
I don't know.
And the dog's tripping right now?
I don't know, the shit is gone, and I'm pissed. I'm pissed about it, because someone actually took that shit.
Wow, wow. Interesting. Somewhere. So anyway, it's funny, because this was, like, I'm a huge fan of Bruce Lee's philosophies and the Jeet Kune Do idea, using that as a model for personal self-expression. A lot of Bruce Lee's ideas about self-actualization and all this kind of, it's beautiful, right? But I believe one of the people who benefited the least from this was Bruce Lee himself, because he was not necessarily walking the walk in all aspects of this, but he can definitely teach it, all right? He can definitely say it. So let's go ahead and continue. Hey, Kung Fu Genius listeners. If you're looking for an easy way to support this podcast, please consider joining the Kung Fu Genius Patreon. You can support for as little as $5 a month and get access to episodes a few days early. Higher levels of support get additional goodies, exclusive content, and even your name in the description. The baller level of support will give you the opportunity to be a Dre for a day and give me a rest from this guy over here. A link for the Kung Fu Genius Patreon page is in the description below. You can also support us by subscribing to the Kung Fu Genius on YouTube, liking this video, and sharing it on your social media platforms. When you subscribe on YouTube, don't forget to hit that bell for notifications so you will know as soon as a new episode or a premiere is available for you to watch. For those of us who listen to us on audio, it's a huge help if you don't just rate the podcast, but also write a review wherever you listen to the Kung Fu Genius, such as Apple or Google Podcasts. I really appreciate it. And now back to me.
Did it achieve that, his time with you? Did you feel that perhaps he learned something from you?
No, definitely not yet. First, because of shooting schedule and all that, I mean, he cannot have it on a regular basis. And secondly, he is still on the level right now of enjoying it as an excitement, like his motorcycle and his sports car, you know, some for release of his whatever, anger, whatever, you name it.
So interesting, he says, like, well, do you think Steve McQueen has actually mellowed out by your martial arts training? And he's like, no. Well, partially because he didn't train. I believe of all the celebrities, I have to talk to John Little again. I believe it was John Little that told me this, but I could be mistaken. I believe that James Coburn was like the celebrity student that actually had the most lessons with Bruce Lee. And I think Steve McQueen's training with Bruce Lee was probably very sparse. Mm-hmm. Because one, I mean, he's a huge movie star. He's shooting a lot. I mean, so was James Coburn at the time, but there are levels to everything, right? And, you know, and like you said, like for Steve McQueen, doing martial arts was just like another thrill, like his motorcycle and his Porsche and stuff like that.
I can see Steve Coburn taking it more seriously too.
Yeah, James Coburn. Yeah, absolutely. Well, you see, there's a lot of backyard footage there where they're doing chi sao and he's working on the kicks and he's really trying. And yeah, I mean, he definitely seemed a lot more dedicated. Clearly, Steve McQueen wasn't letting himself be filmed at Bruce Lee's place, right? Because none of that stuff.
No
exists,
footage
right?
of Steve.
Well, probably. I mean, he was such a big star. If Bruce was like, "Hey, we should film you," say he probably was like, "No." Right. And interesting that there was a bit of competitiveness between Bruce and Steve, and Bruce had bought that Porsche just to compete with him. He was dead broke at that time, got a little bit of money from his father's inheritance when they sold the Nathan Road place or whatever. Right. And, you know, blew it all on a Porsche at that time. Just to keep up with Steve McQueen. So it's funny. He's like, yeah, he likes his sports car and his motorcycle and martial arts as a release. But the thing is, Bruce also was kind of trying to keep up in that kind of world, too. And I think probably what maybe really kept Bruce from breaking through to really becoming the guy that he is, you know, and I'm not saying that Bruce was false and I'm not saying that Bruce was two-faced. A lot of times people espouse a certain philosophy because they're almost trying to stay on board with it themselves. It's like if I tell you how you should live your life to a certain degree, I need to be congruent to what I'm telling you. Otherwise, I'm going to feel like a hypocrite, right? Mm-hmm. So one of the best ways to kind of embrace that philosophy is to teach it, because then you kind of fake it till you make it kind of thing, right? And I think that the one thing that was keeping Bruce really ultimately from breaking through to really being able to do that, and mind you, he was
hanging
that
out with Steve McQueen.
It's Hollywood. It's the entertainment industry, right? He was super disciplined when it came to his training and when it came to like what he ate and stuff like that. But then he still had like a cocaine habit, right? You know, so like there's certain aspects of Hollywood and the entertainment industry that's kind of holding him back. And I'm not saying, oh, it's Hollywood's fault or whatever. But let's be honest. Had Bruce not gone to Hong Kong and made those movies, and he just decided to stay in LA and become a martial arts instructor or whatever, do you think Bruce would have died in 73? Would he have died in 2.5 years? Man. I don't think so. I think that was just all the trappings of celebrity, right? And what are you going to do? So let's go ahead and continue.
Shiv, your screen personality is really you. I mean, you teach martial arts, so you're obviously very good at it. But of course, teachers are not always the best exponents or practitioners.
Right.
Are you able to take care of yourself, would you say?
I will answer it, first of all, with a joke, if you don't mind. Oftentimes, people come up and say, hey, Bruce, are you really that good? I said, well, if I tell you I'm good, probably you will say I'm boasting. But if I tell you I'm no good, you know I'm lying.
Yeah, so it's a very classic line, right? Very famous. They've used that one quite a bit, right? But it's true. And it kind of comes back to what we were saying before between the guy who's kind of humble and, you know, and doesn't say anything, like, oh, that's the guy you really got to worry about. It's like, well, you know, when you're at that level, especially if you have some kind of fame or whatever, and people ask you if you're good, well, I mean, first of all, how are you ever supposed to answer that question? Yeah, no, man, I'm great. I'm awesome. I'm amazing. I have no idea. Like, I mean, like, sometimes people, like, I've been asked questions, not necessarily that question, by either fans of the Kung Fu Genius or people who know me from Wing Chun. They ask, like, these super awkward questions about, like, could you beat this guy?
It is an awkward question.
Or what? And it's like, well, even if I had a strong, like, if somebody said, could you beat this person, right? Or if you were in your prime and that person was in their prime and you guys fought, like, who would win? Even if I had a very strong opinion about the answer, let's pretend, and I'm not saying this is me at all because I'm right. Like the last guy to talk this way. You know me, right? But let's say someone asked me about some other Wing Chun guy, like, do you think you could beat that guy in your prime or whatever, right? And let's say in my heart of hearts, for whatever reason, I felt I would smash this dude.
Yeah.
Let's just say, and I'm not saying I'm that way, and I'm not saying, like, that's the way I think, but, like, let's pretend.
Right. Hypothetical.
Hypothetical, as that guy Dreisen likes to say, right?
Dreisen always. Is there a time machine involved?
Is there a time machine? Well, luckily, this is not an Ask Me Anything episode.
It's funny, but Dreisen did try to open up that door, I think, in the last episode or something like that.
It's not happening, right?
He tried to open up a door. Like
keep banging on that door, but he ain't coming in. You know what I mean?
he tried it, but...
But, like, even if I really believed, like, oh, dude, I would totally smash that dude. Mm-hmm. And then someone asked me, coincidentally, what do you think if you fought that guy? How much of an asshole do you need to be like, oh, bro, I could totally smash that guy? Like, I mean, unless you're a professional fighter and it's your job to hype up fights and talk ish... I mean, like, if you're a martial arts instructor, and let's see if you even really firmly believed you, like, what man says, like, oh, man, I would totally beat that guy? Like, because the moment those words come out of your mouth, you just sound like such a tryhard and such a loser. You know, so, I mean, the thing is, like, there's really no way you can answer that question. So I like his kind of his joke, right? Because he's otherwise not able to answer the question. So that was a verbal bong sell, right? Yeah. He's just giving way, he's just yielding to the power right there.
Okay.
And saying, well, you know, if I tell you I'm no good, you know, if I tell you I'm great, you know, you think I'm boasting. And if I tell you I'm no good, you know, I'm lying. So mm-hmm. What answer do you want me to give you, right? Okay. And then so I think the best way to respond to that kind of question for martial artists is with a little bit of humor or self-deprecating, right? Because I think that makes more sense to be the kind of the more humble dude, because anything else just doesn't sound right, right? And, so, like, do you think you could fight that guy? But, like, oh, man, knockout, 5 seconds. I'd be knocked out in 5 seconds. You just leave it at that and walk away, right? Like, one of my students, like, he's Jimmy, he's a Sifu level student. And one of the students went up to him and be like, yo, man, do you think Wing Chun could beat this style? And Jimmy just said, nah, man, Wing Chun sucks. And it's just, and he's literally a Sifu at the school or whatever, right? The student was like, oh, what? It's like, yeah, at some point you got to be that guy, right? All right, let's go ahead and continue.
Let's just put it this way. I have no fear of opponent in front of me, but I'm very self-sufficient that they do not bother me. And that should I fight, should I do anything, I have made up my mind, and that's it, baby. You better kill me before.
That's really interesting. Because, again, that sounds kind of boastful. And, again, Bruce Lee lovers are going to be like, yo, man, look how that's so cool. Listen to that. And Bruce Lee haters gonna be like, yay, whatever. and you know, like, it's always the same. It's always the same shit. But what's interesting is what I, my takeaway from that is like you better be ready to kill me and all this kind of stuff. That for me is the unquantifiable like factor. It, to a certain degree, it, like I've said before, like if you're if you practice Brazilian jiu-jitsu, but you don't have the confidence to shoot in and go for a takedown and really take the person down, and you have hesitancy, you're not going to be effective. If you're a karate practitioner and you don't step in and go for that punch or go for that kick, it doesn't matter how many years of karate you have. If you're a Wing Chun person and you don't close the gap and get close and, you know, relentlessly apply your forward pressure and nonstop striking, it's not going to work. If you're a, you know, a boxer and you're timid because the guy's kicking you and you don't want to go in, like, the thing that people always forget is, like, yes, to be effective in martial arts, you need to learn a martial art that's, that will address the things that are going to happen in fighting. Punch, striking at long range, close range, clinching, grappling, what can happen on the ground. Different martial arts have different volume dials in terms of, like, how much they do this part over that part. Mm-hmm. But, like, if you're in a competent martial art, they should, you should at least have the volume up on each of those categories somewhere, so maybe a little higher up on others, right? And but even if you are equally awesome at ground fighting and striking and clinching and kicking and flying kicks and Filipino weapons and AK-47, you can do everything, all right? If you don't have the right attitude to relentlessly apply your game plan, literally doesn't matter what you know, all right? They've been karate exponents who got the floor mopped with them by boxers, and there have been boxers who got the shit kicked out of them by karate guys who just crushed them with kicks. So the thing is karate or boxing better than each other? Literally depends on the person. Now, of course, if someone's got better tools, they can edge out someone who's maybe a little more ferocious, but they have like better tools. Like, there's some gray area where there's some overlap with technical game, right? Yeah. But to a certain degree, I mean, look, if someone stands in front of you and you have no confidence that you're going to can step in and Wing Chun punch that guy, karate punch that guy, box that guy, kick that guy, grapple that guy, what the hell does it matter? And so the unquantifiable component is Dao Sam, your fighting heart. And without that, you can forget all of it. Right? You can forget all of it, right? Okay, let's go ahead and continue.
Anger. Yeah. Is shy, diffident. You even stay out of fights in the early scenes because of a promise you made to your mother.
Yes.
Is that a little bit like you, or is this just a screen personality?
This is definitely a screen personality, because as a person, one thing that I have definitely learned, and my life, it seems like it's a life of self-examination and self-peeling of myself bit by bit, day by day, is that I do have a bad temper, a violent temper, in fact. So that is definitely, I mean, some people that I am portraying, you know, not Bruce Lee as he is.
So he's talking about Big Boss, and I think this is the only movie that he addresses directly, which is why I believe it's obviously after Big Boss, but I think it might be before Fist of Fury, right?
Okay.
And, you know, he talks about, because in Big Boss, in Tong San Dai Heng, he, you know, he makes that promise and he can't fight. I mean, like, you know, most people are kind of pissed off because for most of the movie, Bruce cannot fight because of this damn necklace he's got, right? Because he made a promise to his mom. And he shows restraint.
I wonder who has that necklace right now.
Yeah, you know, someone's got it. Someone has a fake one that they bought at an auction for $20,000. The real one is the real one has been lost for a long time ago, right? Yeah, one thing I learned about doing all this Bruce Lee collectible, like hanging out with the collectors, is how much fake Bruce Lee stuff there is out there, man. So, you know, he asks, like, how similar are you to that character? And he's basically saying, hey, look, I have a violent temper. He doesn't have the restraint that his character in Big Boss has, right? And interesting, because this is like a minute after he's talking about he would hope that martial arts would chill out Steve McQueen, right? And then, but then he talks about he's going through his own process, peeling layers, and he has a temper to deal with. So to a certain degree, it sounds like a contradiction, but he's also saying he's on the same level as the people who learn from him. Like, he can help you along your journey by maybe giving you what you need, but he's on that journey same as well. Journey, yeah. And that is very different from the traditional archetype of the Chinese martial arts instructor, which is supposed to be perfect, be the scholar warrior, the upright Sifu, moral and upstanding, and a medical doctor and a badass, and everything that comes out of his mouth is wise, and you know, and him kind of saying he's also going through a process as well. Yeah. All right, so let's continue.
More than any other pictures ever done in Hong Kong, the big boss does show some very explicit sex scenes, doesn't it? What's your reaction to being in bed with a lovely young movie star in front of the whole studio crew? Does it intimidate you? Does it worry you at all?
Well, it certainly would not intimidate me, I can tell you that. Well, it's all right, as long as the script justifies it.
Justifies.
But I definitely do not agree to put something in there just for the heck of it, because it is an exploitation, you know, like, for instance, when I start shooting the big boss, the first question was asked, hey man, how many thousands of feet of film, or films, my English is getting terrible now, is it going to be? My reaction is that, first of all, why do I start fighting? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, motivation.
I mean, oh, definitely. I mean, you see, but it seems like to be the thing now that they go for blood. Sex, just merely for the sake of sex and merely for the sake of blood.
So it's interesting, but he also talked a little bit about that in the Pierre Burton interview. Like, basically, his complaint with other Chinese films is that they were very gratuitous in terms of the use of violence and sex or whatever, which is funny because when you look at most of Bruce Lee's movies, like, through a kind of modern lens, a lot of them were pretty gratuitous as well. But like he said, he wants to justify the violence, right? So, you know, Big Boss, he doesn't want to fight, and then he has to, the, you know, the thing gets ripped off, and, you know, he has basically come to the defense of everybody, so he does it in that kind of way. Now, you notice that the Ted Thomas talks about, like, oh, there's some pretty intense sex scenes in there. Now, if you've seen Big Boss, there's really the scene with the Thai prostitute where she's naked, but in the, I believe in the original Chinese version, the sex scene was extended, and there was an additional sex scene that's not in the Big Boss that most of us have seen, even the Chinese version. And that was, you know, because the Big Boss, they get him drunk. I don't know if you remember.
Yeah.
And then he sleeps with the prostitute, right? And he wakes up and he's like, what's going
he's
on?
He's all
and,
embarrassed.
Yeah.
And then he walks out of
the brothel, and she sees him there and looks where he's coming out of, right? And he's just like, and then kind of walks home, right? And then that's when they start to suspect he's now in cahoots with the boss or whatever, right? Well, in the original Chinese version, there's an additional scene. Because if you remember at the end, before he goes to fight the big boss, once they've killed everybody, right? Mm. And he's going to go there and he's going to sacrifice his life and kill the big boss.
It's like a barn.
Yeah, where they're all staying, right? And they're all murdered. Remember, he comes back and they're all murdered, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then now he's going to go and now get his revenge, right? So he's going to go to the big boss's compound, right?
Okay.
Which, by the way, one of my students went to Thailand. Now, Big Boss was not filmed in Bangkok. It was filmed in Pak Chong. And that that house, estate, or whatever, that was the Big Boss's that had the wall around it,
yeah,
that's still there in Pak Chong, and it looks exactly like it did back in the movie.
Wow.
So he went to Bangkok and then went out of his way to go to Pak Chong because he's a Bruce Lee fan, and found the place. And took a photo of it, and it's like exactly the same, like the way it looked there. So for any kind of Bruce Lee fans who go to Thailand, you go to Pak Chong, you can probably find the place.
I want to see that actual barn house where he kicks. I think he kicks the dude through, and is like,
oh, with the silhouette. Yeah, it's still there right now. Yeah,
I want to see that.
50 years later, that hole is still there, right? Like that, right?
Well, I want to see the extended version of the big boss with the extra sex scene.
Yeah. So anyway, so the extra sex scene. So basically, after the family is killed,
extended.
All right. After the family's killed, he goes back to that house of ill repute with an excellent reputation, and. and basically he has a final go with that woman.
Final go. Right? Wow. I gotta leave, but before I go.
And that's where there's actually a photo you can see where Bruce is fully nude, but it's just like he's got a chair right in front of it there, but you can see like his hip line and everything, and it's a famous photo, and everyone looks at that and goes, oh, when is that in the movie? And there's like he literally goes to the House of Ill Repute with an excellent reputation. He has another go. There's apparently, like, you know, pretty racy scene. And before he leaves, apparently she's got, like, those chips, those potato chips.
Okay.
And he takes them. And that scene was cut out of the international release of Big Boss. So that's why when you see, like, the family is murdered and then he's going to go and he's going to get his revenge and he gets his knives. He's by the river and he's like, you know, he's going to go and get his revenge, right? And then suddenly he jumps over the fence the next day and then he kicks those two dudes and then he eats the chip.
That's where he got the...
Yeah, originally that bag came from... from the House of Ill Repute, all right? But apparently, I mean, it's like, well, you don't really care where to get the chips from. He bought a bag of chips before he's going to go kick some ass, right? No. But apparently in the original cut, he got that bag of chips from there. And it was like the same actress, the same prostitute. And I believe that actress, that Thai actress, I believe she recently just passed too. Mm. So anyway, just so you know that, because like fans who've seen like the international Big Boss might not know that actual scene. That and also the famous saw in the head scene, which never made it into any version. But anyway, that's a whole other story. So let's go ahead and continue.
Since I saw the film, at the stage where you decide you're going to get revenge, and that's obviously leading up to the climax, you suddenly decide to go off and make love to a girlfriend in a bordello.
Yeah.
What's the motivation for that?
Now, the way I look at that, you know, that was a suggestion of the director. And I accept it in such a way, and that is, him being a very simple man, when all of a sudden he made up his mind that he's going to go and either kill or be killed, right? So he walked past by. It's a kind of a sudden thing of human beings. That a thought just occurred, well, doggone it, man, such is the basic need of a human being. I might as well enjoy it, man, before I kick the bucket, you know, like that type of an attitude. I mean, it's just an occurrence, you know.
I think you'd probably agree, Bruce, that the thing that's limited the appeal of Chinese films to Western audiences is that it's very unusual to find a Chinese actor who can act. And when I say that, I mean act in a Western style, in a manner that... would make non-Chinese pay money to see them. You seem to have crossed that barrier. How do you think you've achieved it? Do you think it has to do with your time in the United States?
Oh,
you studied there, didn't you?
Yes, it definitely has, you know, because when I first arrived there, you know, I did the Green Hornet, you know, television series back in 65. And as I look around, man, I mean, I saw a lot of human beings. And as I look at myself, I was the only robot there. Because I was not being myself, and I'm trying to accumulate external security, external technique, the way to move my arm, the way, but never to ask and say what Bruce Lee would have done if, the word if, such a thing happened to me.
So that's interesting. So obviously, and you know, Ted Thomas says, like, you know, well, you're basically saying he's the only Chinese guy that Western people would want to go see because other Chinese films are done or Chinese actors do it in such a way that Western audiences wouldn't want to see that. Well, I don't think that's entirely true because there are some classic Chinese films around that time or even before that time, films directed by the late director Long Gong and also... even like some Shaw classics like Come Drink With Me that did have a lot of Western appeal, but partially they weren't, the Western audience didn't have that much access to it until later. So I don't think it's entirely true, but he is kind of right because a lot of the older films, many of the characters were played off of Chinese opera archetypes, right? So like everyone is kind of playing a role and they have to really fill that characterization. Okay. So they're not doing it in a very personal way, at least that's kind of how I understood it, right? Whereas, you know, American actors, it's always the question of, well, what's my motivation as my character in this scene? So like, but you know, and it's kind of like wooey in Hollywood as it is. Well, to a certain degree, to be a good actor, you really have to live in that character and you have to make that character come alive. Whereas in a lot of Chinese films, a lot of the actors are just playing a very simple stereotype, a representation of a Sifu, a representation of a villain. And it doesn't always have that same kind of individuality that you would say have from those other films. Now, obviously, Bruce had worked in the States. He had done Green Hornet. He had also done TV and done some other things in there as well. He did Marlowe, so he had done another film. And he obviously had a lot of practice there as well. But it's interesting, his big complaint about the Green Hornet was that, you know, he always felt that he was playing a bit of a stereotypical, you know, the way Asians were portrayed at that time. And it really bothered him. And he had even written letters to the producer, kind of, he wanted to get more lines and things like that. And a part of it was that role was also very limited, right? Mm-hmm. But I think that that was very instructive for him as an actor to, like, you know, not play those kind of cookie cutter type roles or not play roles in a cookie cutter type way. So let's go ahead and continue.
I always learn something, and that is to be always yourself and to express yourself, to have faith in yourself. Do not go out and look for a successful personality and duplicate him. Now, that seems to me that that is the prevalent thing happening in Hong Kong. Like, they always copy mannerisms, but they never start from the very root of his being, and that is, how can I be me?
What's interesting there is, you know, what he said, how they just copy the mannerisms.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting is that's exactly what happened when he died, right? What did Hong Kong do? They found a bunch of fake Bruce Lees to copy his mannerisms. And why did that stuff never really pan out?
No.
Because those people were not honestly expressing themselves and doing something new and doing something interesting.
Right.
So it's interesting. Like, he had no idea at this point that about his untimely death and what would happen afterwards. But he literally just said exactly, when something's successful, people just copy it.
Right.
And it's almost as if that is exactly what happened when Bruce Lee died.
That's
right.
Jackie Chan was so successful too. He just kind of found his groove. And
yeah. He had to do something the opposite of Bruce Lee. Right. Absolutely. All right, let's continue.
Never believe the word star. That's an illusion, man. I mean, that's something public calls you. You see? And when you become successful, when you become famous, it's very, very easy to be blinded by all these happenings. Everybody come up to you with Mr. Lee. When you have long hair, they'll say, hey, man, like, that's in, man, baby. That's the in thing. But if you have no name, they'll say, boy, look at that disgusting juvenile delinquent.
Mm.
I mean, too many people are yes, yes, yes to you all the time, you see? So unless you really at that time have gone through quite a lot and understand what life is about, and that right now, man, some game is happening, and realizing such that that is a game.
Interesting, right? And then you see, and some of the things, you could tell that Bruce has a couple little scripts that he likes to run. Not saying that it's insincere, but like, he's got his talking points, right? And he literally says the same thing he says at the Pierre Burton interview. You know, he says, like, you know, star is, you know, something that the public calls you, and it's an illusion. It's, I think, almost word for word to what he said in the Pierre Burton interview.
Okay.
But you can see, like, in the very same way that he was saying, like, that he's hoping that martial arts chills out Steve McQueen. And then a minute later, talking about how he's got a violent temper. Obviously, Bruce is, he's being very critical about celebrity life. But we know from what we've read and from what we've seen that Bruce also embraced it.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Like, he liked to wear, like, the flashy, cool stuff like a star would wear. He wanted to have the Mercedes, and he wanted, you know, he ordered the Rolls Royce at the time of his death. And, you know, he liked the trappings of being a celebrity. So in my opinion, the way I look at what he's saying right now, this is the same thing like he's saying about Steve McQueen calming down with martial arts and then saying he also needs to calm down. This is Bruce saying how he wants to act in relation to his celebrity. But it's not necessarily the way he is, because we know that behind the scenes what's going on. That he is, in certain degree, in certain aspects, living a bit of a life of that excess that entertainers and celebrities have.
Okay.
And but at the same time, kind of saying that it's not good and it shouldn't be that way, and that it's all just an illusion. So he's like, he's aware of it, but he also can't help it. And like we've talked about before, he's also 32. All right.
Yeah.
Like, we cannot forget that. You know, I mean, here, well, obviously, he's either he's 30 or 31 at the time of this interview, right?
I kind of remember being 30.
Yeah, I mean, like, 32. I mean, yeah, you're definitely an adult by that age, right?
I was like, do you remember that?
I kind of remember. I went off the rails. I went off the rails in that era.
Yeah, I mean, I was running my business, but like, I look back at that time period, and I go, oof, like, if that version of me suddenly became a huge celebrity in another country, like. Maybe I'd be dead in 2.5 years. Who knows? Like, you don't know. I mean, like, that's the other thing. Like, Bruce is very mature for his age. I mean, when you listen to the way that he spoke, it's like, you don't find 31-year-olds don't speak like this, right? But he still was also not this guy to a certain degree. Man. All right? Okay, let's continue.
Then it's all right. But most people tend to be blinded by it because, I mean, if things are repeated too many times, you believe in it and it becomes a habit.
The danger is believing the public impression of you.
That's
isn't
right,
it?
Man.
Your father warned you about the bad things in show business. Yes. Have you met them too? Oh, apart from the illusion.
I mean, of course. Of course.
That's right.
So, right, because his father was an actor, right? And he's like, your father gave you advice about, like, you know, essentially the trappings of celebrity, right? Okay. So now I want you to listen to what he says. And I don't want to skew your perspective, okay? But I'm just going to give you an idea, okay? I want you to think of it in terms of the Bob Baker letters, because we know that that's going on literally at this time right now. Yeah. During this interview, he's already received a number of shipments of cocaine from Bob Baker, all right? And he's definitely living that life, and he's definitely having, you know, some extramarital affairs or whatever. So now I want you to listen to what he says, okay? Let's play this.
Well, let me put it this way. To be honest and all that, I am not as bad as some of them, but I definitely am not saying that I am a saint. Okay?
I'm not as bad as others, but I'm definitely not saying that I'm a saint. Mm. Okay? Now, he's talking about the trappings of Hollywood, okay? He's not talking about having a temper. Mm-hmm. They're talking about the trappings of being a celebrity.
Yeah.
So what does it mean when you're a celebrity and you're not a saint? We know what it means. Okay, so of course back then, you know, the interviewer takes it as a bit of a tongue-in-cheek comment, or kind of thinks of it as being a bit sarcastic or whatever. But now, knowing what we know about what was going on during this time,
yeah,
he was kind of being open about it. I mean, not saying directly what it was, but he wasn't hiding that. All right, let's continue.
So you're mainly identified with,
yes,
at this moment. You know, a number of styles of fighting. Karate, judo, yes. Chinese boxing.
Yes.
And it's a question you must have been asked hundreds of times before.
Yes.
Which do you think is the most effective?
You see, my answer to that is this. There is no such thing as an effective segment of a totality. By that I mean, I personally do not believe in the word style. Why? Because unless there are human beings with three arms and four legs, unless we have other group of being on earth that are structurally different from us, then there might be a different style of fighting. Now, why is that? Because we have two hands and two legs now. The important thing is, how can we use it to the maximum in term of path? Well, straight line, curved line, round lines, they might be slow, but depending on the circumstances, sometimes that might not be slow. And in terms of legs, you can kick up straight, same thing, right? Physically, how can I be very so well coordinated? That means you have to be an athlete. That means you gotta have jogging and all this basic ingredient, right? Now, and after all that, then you ask yourself, how can you honestly express yourself at that moment?
So this is a huge bunch of nuggets that he drops there, right? So again, he mirrors some of the things that he said in the Pierre Burton interview, right? Unless you have a being that's structurally different. And also, again, listen to the way he speaks English. You have to realize that he's someone who essentially grew up in Hong Kong, came to America when he was 18, was pretty much a straight D and F student. Yeah. And, and he's saying, like, you know, unless, you know, structurally different beings or whatever. Yeah. I mean, the way that he spoke, like, you would be hard-pressed to move to a foreign country and after 12 years speak that language the way Bruce Lee spoke English, right?
Eloquent.
Yeah, I mean, accent notwithstanding or whatever, like, really remarkable, all right? Like, I mean, I sometimes I listen to his word choice and I go, man, I sound dumb sometimes. But you know what, Dre? Last week, you sounded a lot better.
I know, man.
No, sorry. Not last week. Out. The week before.
It comes out here and there.
Because last week, it was you. Yeah. The week before that, it was you with a different hairstyle, yeah, right? And you sounded really good. I don't know what happened. You did backslid a little bit.
Yeah, very articulate.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but you know, and you see, he talks about, you know, look, we have two arms and two legs. You got a straight line, you got curved, round, you got this, you can use the leg this way, this way, this way. How do you honestly express yourself? He doesn't believe in styles. And so again, these are things that he said before. All right. And again, the other reason why I got no skin in the game in Jeet Kune Do politics, but when Jeet Kune Do people want to argue about what is Jeet Kune Do, what is not Jeet Kune Do, or whatever, he literally just said he doesn't believe in the word style. So I don't think he would be down for anyone arguing about what was or what wasn't Jeet Kune Do at this point, right? Because he very clearly says it, right?
And this is pretty much pretty late in his life. Yeah. He's already made up his mind at that point.
Absolutely. So. All right, let's continue.
Yourself, when you punch, you really want to punch. Not you want to punch because trying to avoid not getting hit, but to really be in with it and express yourself. Now that is that is to me the most important thing, and that is, how can I, in the process of learning how to use my body, to understand myself? Now, the unfortunate thing is, now there's boxing, which use hands, judo, which is throwing. Now I'm not putting them down, mind you, but I'm saying one thing that is the bad thing, and that is, because of style, people are separated. They are not united together because styles became law, man. But the original founder of the style started out with hypotheses. But now it has become the gospel truth. And people that go into it, man, became the product.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, these were really his standard talking points about traditional martial arts, formality in martial arts, right? He's saying, hey, look, the founder had an hypothesis, had an idea, and this was flexible. They're kind of like figuring it out through kind of a scientific, through the scientific method. You have an hypothesis, you test it out. And this thing should be going under constant review. And what happens? These things become crystallized, they become established styles. And then now you have people who are, with like religious fervor, following those different things. And like you said, now you got people who just box, or you have people who do that. Now, one thing is that nowadays, I think one of the good things about things like mixed martial arts is that line is blurred a lot more nowadays, right? Where, you know, a modern martial artist nowadays, I think, is expected to be someone who can kick and punch and has to have some kind of clinching idea and maybe some basic rudimentary stuff on the ground. And it's more normal even for people who practice traditional martial arts. You know, the way we teach Wing Chun, we want to make sure that the students can kick, punch, elbow, knee, clinch if they get thrown or throw the other person, if they get on the ground, how to escape in a basic way, even if we don't specialize in certain aspects of that. But you give them a little bit of a template for dealing with that kind of stuff. And that's a lot more normal nowadays. And, you know, partially could be because of Bruce Lee's influence, but obviously a big part of it has to do with mixed martial arts, right? Yeah. And he was talking about that, you know, and one of my favorite kind of Bruce Lee-isms, which he said a little bit earlier here, is that you cannot have an effective segment of a totality.
Yeah.
Right? You have to have the whole thing together for it to be functional. You cannot have an effective segment. And a specific style is a segment, right? A certain bias towards something is a segment, right? And that is only part of the whole thing, right? Mm-hmm. So let's continue. I think we're almost finished here.
How you are, who you are, how you are structured, how you are built, how you are made, it doesn't matter. You just go in there and be that product. And that, to me, is not right.
Bruce Lee, thank you.
Ted, I thank you, man.
There you go. So, yeah, talking about, you know, how students of various martial arts, they essentially just become products. and they're not living, they're not breathing. Now, we teach a traditional martial art, and this is a huge problem in traditional martial arts, right? But that's why, you know, with my high-level students, my senior students, you know, I hope that, and you can see, I mean, if you look at all the Sifu level instructors that we have here, none of them really move the exact same way. I mean, they all teach Wing Chun. They all teach Wing Chun according to the program. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Nicole's expression is different from Barry's, is different from Craig's, is different from Jimmy's. Mm-hmm. You know, you have all these people that teach Wing Chun under my banner, but they have, you know, their personality goes through. And of course, we want to teach it according to the capabilities of the student, right? And that, you know, now it's very self-evident, right? We're like, yeah, of course, you got to cater the way you teach it or whatever. But those things were not self-evident to martial arts instructors back then. And that's why some people, I feel, they unfairly criticize Bruce Lee, like, you know, like, yeah, nowadays you do this. Nowadays, all right? But you always have to look at people within their time period, right? If you look at the way...
it wasn't a thing back then.
If you look at the way martial arts were presented in the early 60s and early 70s, I mean, it was very cookie cutter, right? It wasn't like, oh, I'm going to teach you... this karate style based on your body type. It's like you learn the forms, the applications, and the sparring, and you're going to do it and try to do it like your sensei, who may have a completely different body type than you mm-hmm. have, right? So this stuff that he's saying, which is so self-evident to modern martial artists now, this stuff was super revolutionary back then, right? And there's still a huge segment of the martial arts world which isn't even up to this point mm-hmm. in terms of being open-minded in looking at these things critically. They're still in the Stone Ages, right? And then there are other people who they look at this stuff and go, it's totally obvious. Well, it wasn't obvious then when he said it, all right?
That's what's so fascinating about it.
Yeah.
It's totally so long ago that this happened.
Yeah.
But we weren't there.
No. And we take it for granted now, this kind of attitude. Yeah. Cool. So that was a lot of fun. And hey, man, we got through the entire Ted Thomas interview in one episode.
Did that.
And I think we did it justice. I don't feel that we really rushed it, you know. I think we did okay.
Okay.
All right, cool. And that's all I got to say about that. All right, guys. So what did you think about today's episode? How do you like these conversations I do with Bruce Lee? Do you have any ones you want me to do? I'm definitely going to do a few more in the future. I don't know how many they are, but if you want me to go over any kind of conversations, whether it's Bruce Lee or someone else, hit me up in the comments below. And if you have any questions for us to answer in a future episode of The Kung Fu Genius, go ahead and write those comments below. Don't forget to like and subscribe to The Kung Fu Genius, and I'll see you guys next time. Word is I'm a kung fu genius. Technique speaks for me, not lineage. Forget Jet Li, cause I'm the one. Many call me Sifu, but to you I'm Seagung. And I produce masters, you surpassed us. Your kung fu stiffer than corpse and caskets. City Wing Chun is the house I built. Violate the gate and your blood gets spilt. Alex Richter, always the... Alright Dre, we got places to be. This is the first time we're doing it without writing it down. So this is like a test of your...
mental prowess?
Mental prowess.
Prowess.
Cool, let's do one more. You were a little iffy around the...
Which one?
Ted Thomas Bruce Lee.
You know when you like kind of watch a film or a YouTube video and it lags a little bit? So it's like...
Yeah.
You know, on today's episode of the Kung Fu Genius... Andrew can edit that. Genius?
He can tighten that up.
No, he can't. Dude, he's not like a Marvel CGI wizard, okay? Just give him good stuff. Don't f*** it up.
He's holding the knives.
Lots of gems. All right, peeps. On today's episode of The Kung Fu Genius,
what are you... I'm not doing anything. I'm not even looking at you.
The genius will be breaking down the Bruce Lee interview. The genius will be breaking down the Kung Lao. Feng Kao.
Feng Kao? What is this and why is this in the art? What is this?
What is that?
What is this?
The genius will be breaking down the Tia Thomas Bruce Lee episode. Flippin' ever goof zoga. Show your lunch. I've shown up. All right, peeps. All right, bye. All right, peoples.